the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette. This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you being with us for the first show of the new year. And if you've ever got a question you'd like to be on the program, you can email that to news@wbaa.org and tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. President, hello to you. Did you have a good holiday?
Really excellent. For once in my life, everything was caught up. I don't mean just work, but errands, chores, little fix-its, and all those little loose ends. So it won't last, but it was awfully nice to come back and feel that I was current on all fronts.
It's good to have the honey-do list and the university do list both get down to zero at some point.
You put those in the right order, by the way.
I'm married, too. Right. I know how it goes. So let me start with a question that's come in from a listener since you were last on the show. It's from Tim, who's a researcher at Purdue. He writes, last year, you used your prominent position and correctly defended the science of GMO technology against unfounded political attacks. He says, when are you going to do the same thing to defend the science of climate change? Tim says, as with GMOs, there is a clear scientific consensus about the causes and many of the implications of climate change. We researchers at the Purdue Climate Change Research Center would welcome the opportunity to help you craft a clear, scientifically grounded statement that forcefully highlights the need to confront this critically important global challenge. And he even sent some suggested language, which just would change your GMO statement. So instead of talking about GMOs, it would say the attack on climate science is the most blatant anti-science of the age. And so I guess Tim wants to know, would you be willing to issue such a statement?
Well, we'd think about it. I've talked about it before. I think the science is pretty clear that anthropomorphic causes are playing a major role in affecting climate. So I've said that before. The GMO statements were very central to a big major speech I'd been asked to give, and it seemed like just the right occasion to talk about it, and are very, very central to, of course, many of the disciplines here at Purdue. But, you know, I think on this count, the scientific community is doing a pretty darn good job of speaking for itself. And the GMO, I think there's a whole lot more there'd been a whole lot more, I'm going to say, intimidation of the and too few people speaking up. So,
do you think that the university community adding its voices to the scientific research that's already out there would help to do things like sway those members of Congress who are on the fence about it?
I don't know. There's an awful lot of noise. The media is full of it all the time. Those who are swayable probably have been. You know, I think the real issues here are less about the science than what we do about it. And there are still questions about the accuracy of the computer models that purport to tell us what's going to happen decades from now. They haven't been very accurate so far, but that doesn't mean they're not accurate in the long term. But that's one difference. I mean, the GMO situation is one where we've got decades now of actual results which demonstrate safety and value and all the rest. The climate issue is much more forward-looking. And then even assuming that the models are or will prove accurate, you got a big question. I think the biggest questions really are what do we do about it? And some of the things that are proposed to do about it, frankly, I think are not well conceived. They would be unbelievably expensive, ruinous to the poor nations of the earth, and probably not move the thermometer. So the real hard work, I think, is to be done on, you know, and a lot of it's going on at Purdue. What's the range of options for dealing with this problem? Let's pick the smart ones.
And if, like Tim, you'd like to get your question on the program, you can always email that to news@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, right now, there's a group of students sitting in Hovde Hall hoping you'll talk to them about some demands that they are making of you. And that comes following the appearance of some white supremacist literature on campus last year. I want to play a little bit of the program from last month so that people know a little bit about this issue and about what you said about it, just as some backdrop. So here's that.
I'm answering letters and emails every day now from people who were pleased that we kept some sense, as they saw it, of proportion about this and didn't, as they see it, overreact. And I do think it's important to note that these few posters on their face didn't say anything that I had that one, I think, can attack. They said, we have a right to exist. That's a fairly innocuous statement. I don't know that anyone's arguing the contrary. You know, say a pro-ISIS group put up some cardboard posters here, then they said, season's greetings. How strongly should we condemn them when they haven't done anything and they haven't even yet said anything hateful?
So with that as backdrop, so people know a little bit about it, I want to know, do you have a plan to meet with these students who are essentially asking the kind of the same things as when this came up at the end of last year?
Well, we might. I meet with students probably as much as any of my predecessors, if not more. I think I've got 3 student meetings today as we're the day we're taping. You know, we give priority to those who've been waiting. We give priority to those who haven't already had a chance. I mean, I spent a lot of time on this subject, including well over an hour face-to-face with this group or its recent predecessors.
So it sounds like part of your concern here is this sort of second bite of the apple philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I've got a long list of student groups that I'm always trying to make time for, and these folks have been through once. They have nothing new to say. You know, they brought a list of 10, as they call them, demands. And on about 5 of them, we're in some agreement, and we're working. We've got the most diverse student body Purdue's ever had. That was one of their interests. We're working really hard to recruit faculty. That was another one. We raised a record amount of money for scholarships for first-generation minority students. That was another one. They wanted some kind of a committee of safety that they could participate in. We formed it. So, you know, there was a lot we agreed on. These other things, we don't. We're not going to. A meeting wouldn't change that. So we're going to continue to – we'll work our way through the requests we have, but, you know, whether we'll get to them, not clear.
One of the other things on their list for our listeners is that they would like a class that all Purdue students would take that talks about racism and diversity. And when I went over and chatted with them very briefly this morning, one of the things they said was – and I have not been able to verify this – that – they believe Purdue is the only Big Ten campus that does not have some sort of diversity requirement for all of its students. Is that a fair statement?
I don't know. We certainly have – we devote a lot of time during the freshman orientation week to this. I mean, this campus does not lack for communications about this subject. We spend, last I looked, $13 million on diversity offices and programs. They're all over this campus. We're not going to have that class they're talking about. So we just ought to, you know, we just ought to move on, as people like to say.
Let me give you a chance to explain why that class specifically you think is not going to happen.
Because the tuition students pay here, you know, comes hard for a lot of students, and we ought to make certain that they have as much choice as they can about how to spend those dollars.
So you saying that you have so few times for electives at Purdue anyway that you don't want to mandate one more class?
That's exactly right. And again, especially on a subject which is so widely discussed all the time in a variety of other forms.
What about an encouragement to professors to, where possible, talk about their topics in as diverse a way as possible?
A, I don't think that's particularly necessary on this subject. B, I don't tell professors, or I don't presume to, you know, tell professors what they ought to talk about in their classrooms.
This is the monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels on this Indiana Public Broadcasting Station. We're glad you're with us. Let me talk about some of the aspects of your yearly letter that you've sent out to the Purdue community. You talk a lot about risk in this year's letter, and you say there are some choices being made now that either could be great successes or, frankly, could fail. Which ones are you referring to specifically that maybe the ones that you worry most might go the wrong way?
Well, the high school is one. It's a very ambitious project, and I describe in the letter, pretty self-evident, I guess, why this might not work, but also why it's important to try. Again, in the interest of having more minority students and low-income students able to access a Purdue education. Anything that involves capital expenditure could very well be a risk poorly chosen. In this week that where we're taping, Stan, yet another – you don't have to search very hard – yet another big, big essay 2 days ago in a national publication about you know, forecasting that 90% of American colleges will be gone in 10 or 15 years because there'll be so many more ways to become educated much less expensively. And, you know, we – the letter explains. We don't sneer at that notion. We don't – we're not in denial about this – these various threats to the model we've known. We're working hard at Purdue to try to build value that cannot be replicated by some alternative route or even by the most dazzling technology. But anybody who doesn't see that these – forecasts are at least credible, I think, has their head in the proverbial sand. So anything that involves major commitments of capital, we have to be thoughtful about. We have to be pretty sure that that building or whatever it was you – all those new people you hired, if it's faculty, you almost have to think of it as capital because they're – here for life.
Payroll is the most major expense.
Yes. And you have to be pretty confident that you'll still be needing those assets in 10 and 15 and 20 years.
Well, you certainly note the higher education skeptics in your letter. And while it is true that there is waste in higher education, public education, as there is in most large enterprises somewhere, is this the time to push that you are different and how you are different than, say, the for-profit institutions that have cropped up? You mentioned that there are ways for people to get all but worthless certificates that are being accepted out in the job world, and that is certainly happening. How do you do a more public way of differentiating Purdue from those sorts of institutions?
Two things. First of all, this is although there's some egregious examples in the for-profit side, this is not a for-profit, non-profit side. A lot of those worthless diplomas are coming from, in my opinion, are coming from non-profit, you know, traditional colleges where there's no rigor left, where students are studying sometimes frivolous subjects as opposed to something serious, which tends to predominate here at Purdue. So that's not the dichotomy I have in mind when I say that some higher education or others say that some higher education is more valuable than others. But in terms of differentiating Purdue, I think it's happening anyway. Market research we have shows it. Record applications show it. We haven't, and I think it might be a little unseemly to go out and unduly promote the idea that we've chosen a slightly different course. But that doesn't mean people don't know it. And I travel around this country visiting with alums and students and audiences interested in higher ed. They know that we've been a little more careful about cost. They know that we are trying to concentrate our resources on the disciplines that seem most relevant to the economy and to people's futures. Young people's futures. They know that we have a stronger commitment to free speech and the protection of expression, whether we agree with it or not, like those few young people who are over here at Hovde now. So I don't think beating our chest too much about that. We could. Sometimes it's been suggested. You're not the first to bring it up. I think we – I always say we're not preaching what anyone else should do. We are simply trying to make decisions that are best for this university and for the state that supports it so extensively. And if that gets noticed and attracts students or donations or other kinds of support from elsewhere, that's great.
You say that you don't think it's a for-profit versus not-for-profit debate. I've heard from the Senate President David Sanders, University Senate President, who's made speeches talking about how he thinks he can help with your push towards lowering student debt if there is more focus from students and faculty and staff at Purdue and other places on the for-profit people. He says, look, these are the colleges that are causing people to have huge debt loads and not get anything from that debt. So I wonder if you guys can coalesce around a common enemy there and say, look, there's no question that a Purdue education is worth more than a University of Phoenix education. So why not try to both differentiate yourself that way and then go and say, look, and we can bring down the overall student debt, which will be a good for the country in the process.
Yeah, to an extent, but it's a very particular passion of Professor Sanders, and he's right up to a point, but he needs to look harder at the data. There are all sorts of very bad outcomes records on the nonprofit side. It's just way too simplistic to suggest that the for-profits don't do a good – some of the for-profits do a darn good job, actually, compared to some of the not-for-profits. I agree that more of the problems are on that side of the – have been on that side of the ledger. You know, in the week we're talking, as they were leaving, the last U.S. Department of Education rather sheepishly admitted they've been completely wrong in their reporting of student debt payment, less than half of all students. So this is – this covers the whole spectrum from for-profit to the most traditional, are not making payments on their loans. They've already written off, and this they've already written off the biggest loss in U.S. credit history, $23 billion last year, and that's just the beginning. So the student loan program is a mess, and it's not just the one sector, the for-profit, that's involved.
A couple other things that were in your letter. I wanted to ask about your mention of Jimmy Doolittle, because this fascinated me. I'm a student of history, as I know you are, and allow me to set this up, if you will. I knew enough about Jimmy Doolittle to know about the Doolittle Raids, which, as people may or may not know, were launched in the early part of the U.S. involvement in World War II, just after Pearl Harbor. Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to send a message that we could respond because morale was low after Pearl Harbor, understandably. But the mission itself, Jimmy Doolittle thinks he's going to get court-martialed because he knows he's going to lose almost all of his planes. And sure enough, 15 of the 16 of them crash after dropping their bombs on Japan. A few American soldiers die, and there was not a whole lot of material damage done to Japan. Your whole letter is about what is an acceptable risk. Was it smart to invoke Jimmy Doolittle, who I think if you posed this military operation today, he'd get laughed out of the room?
Well, I think it was smart. I mean, if you study his whole career, he was known, as I mentioned in the letter, he was known as the master of the calculated risk. He was the first person ever to fly an airplane. They put a hood over him. He was flying by instruments. He wanted to demonstrate that you could successfully and safely land a plane when you couldn't see where you were going. That sort of thing. But he didn't do that until he had studied the science of it. He was at MIT between the wars and was a – you know, I thought he was a useful point of departure, let's say, for this particular letter because, yes, he was known for doing some very risky things in peacetime and war, but not without having thought them through. In the case of the raid, first of all, the – there was a command decision made that a demonstration, as you put it, sending a message, was worth doing. You're quite right. There was never any prospect they were going to materially harm the Japanese war capability with 20-odd bombers. But it did have the effect of stunning the world and the Japanese and lifting the spirits of Americans, which was probably its principal goal. Could a plane take off successfully? They worked on it on the desert, but could that happen off a carrier under bad weather conditions? Nobody knew, but it wasn't wildly reckless. It was again a calculated risk, like many he took in the rest of his career. And I just thought that might be an interesting way at least to get people reading this, starting reading the letter.
Let's move on to some other things. Of course, Betsy DeVos, the Education Secretary nominee, is somebody who has played a role in Indiana as well, helping to expand school choice. While you were governor here in Indiana, there was some conversations with her and her groups. I wonder if she continues to do that, if she's confirmed as Education Secretary, what, if anything, does that do to the Purdue student body or to your recruitment if there is even more school choice available to people nationwide?
Well, it could only help because typically where school choice is broadened, it begins and sometimes ends with low-income students and students who are in failing districts, students who are never – the kind of students who are never going to make it to college, let alone Purdue, under current circumstances. So if it grew and if it were practiced successfully. It might lead to more of those candidates we're looking so hard for all the time, the kind we're going to try to create at our own high school if we possibly can. So I don't know that it would have a big effect, but if it had one, it would be on the upside.
On to a few other things. I wanted to ask you about Donald Trump's push to bring back more manufacturing jobs. This was, of course, a huge thing in the campaign. And I wanted to ask about it in relation to the types of students who are going into industries that Purdue is trying to manufacture. Because you're talking about, I think, in some ways, empowering young thinkers so that they don't necessarily go into the types of jobs that the people in the Rust Belt seemed to want back in the election. Is there a dichotomy there between the advanced jobs that you want Purdue students to go into versus the jobs that I think a lot of people were thinking Donald Trump would bring back?
Well, I don't think there's any contradiction here. I mean, we hope that Purdue is preparing students for the world, whatever it looks like. Students who have a really good grounding in not just the technologies that are so dominant in the economy today, but also ready to be good citizens in the broadest sense, and prepared to keep learning as they will have to, and probably changing careers as the economy does. Now, Purdue, for all its history, has been a leading producer of leadership for industry and manufacturing and these kinds of realms, which are still very important. They take fewer – it's needs to be restated every so often. America makes more stuff, measured any way you want, than we ever have. It just takes fewer people to do it. But it takes very well-trained and bright people of the kind that we believe Purdue excels at preparing. So I think you're absolutely right that our students now are contemplating and preparing for a much wider range of possible futures than maybe was the case 20 and 30 years ago. But somebody's going to need be able to lead the companies, whatever they look like, that are producing the high-value goods that let's all hope that the U.S. remains a major producer of.
You mentioned the need for continuing learning, and of course that's something that a university should encourage. That brings me to something else I wanted to ask you about, which is this set of policy proposals from the Aspen Institute, which you and Mark Warner from Virginia are leaders in. And one of the things it says is an important component of American future prosperity is, and I'm quoting now, empowering workers by providing them with the tools to improve. So I want to ask you, how do you fight against what seems to be an American electorate that in a large part just said loud and clear, we don't want your job training, we just want our old jobs back? I mean, it seems like there are millions and millions of people who don't want the learning, they just want to get to retirement doing what they were initially trained to do. Is there a problem there?
Well, the problem is I think you've misread what people were saying. I didn't get
that.
I didn't get that at all. I mean, people want to see high-quality jobs in those places and for those people who have been most dislocated by changes in the economy and in the world economy and so forth. And
but there was definitely a backlash from people who said, I don't want to learn to do a new thing. I just want to be able to know that I have a job to go to. Mm-hmm. So don't send me to a classroom. Send me to a manufacturing line.
Well, you heard something I didn't hear. To any such people, the answer would be or could be that let's all work together to make a family-supporting jobs more plentiful. But there's a real responsibility. I mean, somebody needs to say honestly to a lot of Americans, you have a lot of responsibility here. I mean, let's start with something basic. Don't use drugs. You talk to Indiana manufacturers and other employers say all the time, they've got lots of high-quality jobs open, and then people show up, and as many as 70%, I've heard people say, can't pass a drug test. Training yourself or being open to training of the kind that most jobs these days require, at least some training at the front end, and maybe continuously, is another. I mean, there's an element of personal responsibility here that's very, very important, and it's sometimes left out. People are very, very quick to identify the victims of, you know, globalization or the victims of some other phenomenon, and not so ready to say to those people, you've got something you need to do for yourself here. Very soon, I'm welcoming to campus a very interesting person named J.D. Vance. He wrote the book called Hillbilly Elegy that many people thought foreshadowed the Trump phenomenon. And he is very plain spoken at the end of that book in saying to his fellow, he would say, Appalachians, you've got some work to do in terms of getting yourself educated, getting yourself, ready, you know, for responsible work and citizenship. Don't just sit around blaming it on someone else. That's far too broad a tendency across our whole country these days. And to claim victimhood and then be silent on the obligations that would go with someone who really wants a better station in life for themselves.
Real quick, one more thing that came up in your letter. You mentioned the Purdue Polytechnic High School, and you talk real briefly in the letter about, hey, if this thing in Indianapolis works, maybe we can expand it across the state. Maybe we can have a network of these. In a 45-second answer, what do you need to show in the test model in Indianapolis that shows you this is an acceptable risk to go forward statewide?
Young people who have spent, most of them at least, 8 years in a school system which is not producing college-ready graduates need to be college-ready or life-ready. I'm going to say ready for a quality job or at some post-secondary education 4 years later. And if we can do that, if we can do that in inner city Indianapolis, then I know this is thinking too far out there, but I do at least imagine a day when Purdue might operate others of those. We've got in every corner of the state, we have young people who are reaching the age of 18 or 19, and if they got a high school diploma, they really are not ready for more. And so that's ambitious. But I can't think of a better cause.
All right. Well, we've run out of time, but thanks as always for your time, and we'll look forward to doing it again next month.
See you then.
This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Remember, you can email questions for this show anytime you like to news@wbaa.org. You can tweet them at @WBAAnews on Twitter, and you can find all of these shows archived at WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Major support for the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Gaylor Electric. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at gaylor.com. Support also comes from Purdue University Press, publishing global scholarship and popular regional work since 1960 and featuring Calculated Risk, The Supersonic Life and Times of Gus Grissom. More at thepress.purdue.edu.